Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. Joining me today is Orla Foyle, a poet, novelist and short story writer who lives in Galway. Orla's latest collection, Three Houses in Rome, is out now with Dura Press. Orla, I want to bring you back in time to when you were growing up and just kind of what kind of a reader were you? What kind of books were around? And if you have a really early memory of what you read when you were a child. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, if there's a book from that time that you would save.
Okay. Well, I've always... Yeah, that's a really good question. We see, when I was growing up, we didn't really have much TV where we were living, so books were the big thing. And my mother was and is still a great reader. And she read an awful lot of English, American, and we were living outside of Ireland at the time. So I wasn't really kind of introduced to Irish writers as such. But there were a few, like there was Joyce and there was Beckett on my mother's shelf, and that was about it. And she loved Beckett. And still does. And then when I was really young, I used to read these books. I think they were called American Classics Edition. They came out in like 12 volumes, and we had the 12 volumes. And so I was used to long when I was reading to get to the 12th. And then Brothers Grimm, I think, were a big thing with me. If I had those books now, the 12, I would save them because I'd say they're possibly like they'd be vintage or
collectibles.
They'd be collectibles. So I remember that.
Just going to stop there because you said the Brothers Grimm, and that was a big part of my childhood. I always get confused between the Brothers Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen.
Yes, so do I. Yeah,
who did which ones? Because they were at the same time. Do you remember a particular, because they're quite malevolent, but do you remember a particular Brothers Grimm fairy tale that stayed with you?
I don't know, but it's the one that did stay with me, but I don't know if it's theirs. Do you know what I mean? Because I used to read so many fairy tales. It's the one about, oh God, all I have is the image of this little boy and his fingertips have been cut off.
Oh my goodness. It's not the tinderbox, is it?
No, it isn't. It isn't. The tinderbox is lovely. The tinderbox is such a romantic story. That really spoke to me as a little girl growing up. I used to feel sorry for the poor soldier.
Yeah, you know, the red shoes is one that was like haunted me. The red shoes, and she couldn't stop.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, it's red shoes because she just kind of, because when you read the original, she's just dancing and dancing, her feet are bleeding and everything. Yeah. And then you watch a film like, the very famous film, Pressburger and Powell.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's really good. It's it has Moira Shearer. I think she was a ballet dancer. But you see, I love old films.
Yes, me too.
I adore old films. And it was on recently on TV. And it's just amazing. It's sort of, it follows the Grimm thing. It follows the Grimm storyline, you know? So, yes, Brothers Grimm, I liked them because if you read them in the original, they're just like children will be having nightmares. Just so amazingly, they were just there to warn people.
They were dark, but they were like quite sort of, well, not moral in the sense of a sort of a Christian morality, but there was a really kind of open the box and find out vibe.
I liked the one that came close to them, but with a tongue in cheek, was Roald Dahl when he did these tales. Red Riding Hood, but it's sort of it's wonderful. They have them on at Christmas time. They're these cartoons, and it's basically just how Red Riding Hood, stares at the wolf, and her eyes don't flicker, and she pulls a pistol from her knickers. And I thought that was lovely, because then she uses it to kind of basically
bash.
Yeah, it was just so and Spike Milligan even more. I mean, I adore Spike Milligan more, like Roald Dahl. He was a bit harsh, and you read all these stuff about authors that you love, and they turn out to be feet of alarming grey, muddy colour.
It's true.
Yeah.
Well, we'll leave the artist and the art for another podcast. But so you had the brothers Grimm and your mom. I'm sorry, can I ask where you were? Is it okay to ask where you were?
We were living in Africa. We were living in Kenya, and then later on in Malawi. I was born in Nigeria. My parents were teaching there, and then we lived for a while in Ireland and went out. So we kind of went backwards and forwards, but we clocked up a number of years in Africa, and then we emigrated to Australia. So that's why, I mean, I wasn't really shown that much Irish literature. And when you came home to Ireland, you had the books in school and that kind of thing. And I did get to know a bit about Peg, but I couldn't get into Irish, which is a real pity, because it's a beautiful language, and I'm trying to teach it to myself at the moment via Duolingo and books, you know. So I didn't really know about Frank O'Connor or anything until I came home. And then, of course, when I was in Malawi, I was 13, so I thought then I could start reading adult books. So I started with Strumpet City by James Stevens, which to me was a great book. You know, I loved it. Rasher's Tyranny, and then The Priest was so up himself. You know, you really got into the characters, you know.
So I was going to say, it's no bad thing, Orla, that you weren't particularly immersed in the same thing that everyone else was being immersed in. I mean, that sounds like an incredible life experience and cultural experience. And so the books that you were having access to were, you know, was world literature. And
it was, yeah. Excuse me too. Yes. I mean, because you were meeting, because where you were living, our social friends, they were all nationalities, you know. Predominantly Catholic, because my parents would be teaching Catholic schools. So you'd even meet English Catholics, which was, so when I came home to Ireland,
exotic.
That you met English Catholics, you know, and you're going, they're there. And French and Italian, German.
Which is obviously a bit of an influence on your collection, but we'll come to that later on.
It was a very kind of, we moved around a great deal. We changed homes a great deal. So the downside of it is that I didn't make that many friends, you know, and you kind of get used to being temporary in places. Yeah.
So it's that kind of anchorless feeling in a sense.
Yeah, so you get used to that. So the longest of, so now at the moment I'm living in Galway, and I'm pretty anchored here, because most of the family here are around Galway. So it's worked out okay in the end, you know.
And when you did come, I'm going to say back home, but it wasn't really back home for you, but you came to you said you read Strumpet City around 13, a kind of age, and then when did you come back to Ireland, and how did your reading then? You said you couldn't get into Peg, and it's like, was that around that time, like around 14, 15, 16?
I wasn't yet 14, and I can remember like everything was so totally different, Ruth. You know, it was really, never mind the weather, but everybody was white, and I remember I had to have my confirmation. I hadn't had my confirmation. It was huge uproar in the school. I hadn't had my confirmation. And at age 14, I had to make my confirmation. And somebody said to me in school a couple of days later, saw you up there with all the little girls and boys making your confirmation. And I was like, and I just thought, oh, this, you know, I was a sort of very quiet person, so I wouldn't say what I was thinking, you know, which is basically like, you know, get lost. So yes, and what I couldn't get over also was the fact, yeah, I didn't know Irish, and I was told I had to learn Irish, and I tried. I would have loved to have understood Peg. Everybody was going on how they hated Peg. And I thought, God, you know, it's a pretty awesome life. You know, I didn't use that word awesome to myself, but it was an amazing life to be living on those islands. And, you know, I thought, but I couldn't get into it, as in I couldn't read it. Nobody would enjoy it for me or try and get me to enjoy it. You know, like the teachers were sort of, you have to learn this. And, you know, everybody hated it. And then, of course, as I mentioned, there was Frank O'Connor and Maria Edgeworth. And later on, then, of course, I fell in love with Molly
King.
Yeah, Molly King.
Like Good Behaviour. Really yeah, Good Behaviour.
Good Behaviour. I read her and I thought, well, at long last, somebody that, you know, I could sort of really sort of imagine being, you know, like her characters. I loved her characters.
Yeah, she's so witty as well.
Yeah, she is. And she's not, well, she kind of didn't strike me as Irish. Do you know what I mean? Maybe that's why I really liked her, because in an awful lot of the Irish literature, which I enjoyed, they're all Irish, very Irish. And when I read Molly King, I kind of understood her a bit better. You know,
just perhaps the slightly more European context in the way she writes as well. Could be.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I would say so, maybe, yes. So, yes, I actually gave her petrol. Once I filled up her car. We were living in Kilmessan.
Great story.
Yeah. And she came and she asked me to, my big job. I don't know how old I was, but my big job was to man the petrol pumps. And, you know, and so she came in, filled up. And when she was gone, she was very nice, very businesslike, you know, very, you know, not overtly friendly or anything like that. And when she was gone, my mother then said to me, do you know who that was? And I said, I haven't a clue. Who was she? And that was, you know, Mary Lavin. So that was it. So
it's Mary Lavin.
Mary Lavin.
Oh, no, you're the same. I'm exactly the same. I mix up. Like they're just in the same bracket. And they're sort of same era as well.
That's right, yeah.
So I'm going to take you on a little bit. So I and again, if I'm being too personal or I'm prying, just, you know, tell me to take a walk. So after school, then, Orla, did you go on to college or did you stay in Ireland, or where did life take you?
I did a Bachelor of Arts and Humanities in Australia, in Sydney. We moved to Sydney and we lived there for a number of years. So I did my college education in Sydney, and it was lovely. It was so good. You got, I don't know whether they still have it, but I'm sure they do, off study. So you get paid every week for being a student.
Oh,
you got
off
study. And it's a bit like the back to education, but I think it was better. And it was just, you know.
And was it humanities that you did, or you did English, or you did literature?
English. I did English. I did history. I even did religion. I did very kind of vigorous religion. Like we had really, it was really good, actually. It sounded like it wouldn't have been, but it was. It was the Catholic College of Education. It's now a uni. And you'd think that it would be a little bit narrow, maybe, or something, but it wasn't. I can remember we had people who came in and spoke to us who didn't believe anything. And you were encouraged to debate and fight for your principles. And I really liked that, because I was very quiet. But I liked it. If I felt strongly enough about something, I'd stand up for it, you know. And I liked that. I liked the questioning, always the questioning. So that was good. I liked the fact
that it's deep existential exploration. It's not, you know, that's.
Yes.
And so much part of being a writer then is
it
that.
It is. Yeah, I mean, that's what it is, because most of your time as a writer, you're questioning all the time. You never have answers. You just have this. I don't know if you ever get this mad wide feeling in your head that you can see the whole question, you can see every inch of the question, you just cannot get the answer.
But it's also just trying to get that down in the bloody page. You know, you can see all that, and then your attempt at trying to, you're like, that's not what I was, I know what you're talking about. So I suppose coming sort of into your adult life and your, you know, as you're maturing and everything else, I'm curious as if there is a book that you revisit, that you come back to as a touchstone, that you read again and again, if there's something.
Yes, it's funny, actually. I have a number of books like that. Poetry, Marina Tsvetaeva, all of her poems and her prose, though, especially Art in the Light of Consciousness. I came across that a number of years ago. And I just love what she says about being a poet and being a writer, being creative. Like, to her, it was a religion. It's a bit like that with me, too. But to her, it was just almost to the point where she actually neglected her kids, which is a bit frightening. And she also very firmly believed in love. She had love affairs, male, female. But she never lost this absolute, infinite love for poetry and words. She was a fantastic poet. And she was also a brilliant essayist. There are a number of the eight essays in this book. And there's one of the Poet and the Critic, where she basically stands up for poetry against all critics. And she lost an awful lot of friends. So consequently, when the Bolsheviks came to power and she fled Russia, and she was over living in Prague and in Paris. She was, to begin with, people published her, but as soon as she came out with that essay about the critics, they dropped her. So she was starving really for quite some time. And she had to start kind of, I think she had to go back to Russia. She went back to Russia because the whole of her family were back in Russia. They all returned to Russia and she went back. But she wrote another, that's a fascinating, if you ever get to read that essay.
Well, I was going to ask, I mean, obviously you can't just, you know, repeat what she says in the essay, but what the kind of bones of it, like, was it like a fierce polemic, like against the critics? Like, what was at the heart?
It was against the critics. Yeah. So they knew nothing about poetry. What did they know? The book's upstairs. I didn't bring it down with me. I'm really sorry, but I can send you a couple. I'll email you a couple of the lines from it if you like.
Yeah, I'd love that.
She just basically said that the critics don't know anything, and she was talking about Boris Pasternak and about his poetry and how superb it was, how the critics can't deal with truthful poetry. They will go for the bombastic, they will go for the easier understood poetry, they won't go for the poetry that frightens them, or they won't go for the poetry that kind of, you know, they can't understand or won't understand. I wish I'd learned off a line from it now, but I will email you a line.
Yeah, do please.
Just for yourself, no, you know.
So she was lambasted for that, ostracised for that.
She was ostracised. Hardly anybody would publish her poetry after that. And some people would say, well, she was too bloody minded, you know. But this is what I mean. She really believed in poetry. And that's what I admire about poets like her and writers like her. They feel that they have this almost God-given journey to become a poet. And I remember reading about their work and reading their lives and thinking, that's real faith in your creativity, you know. Mm-hmm. And you're not sort of brought up to believe in faith in your creativity, faith in God, or faith in the government, or faith in the rule of law or society, but not your creativity. It's almost down there, you know. It's unpredictable, and it could lead you astray. that kind of thing, you know.
Really interesting what you're saying there. I can really relate in some senses that the it comes from a similar kind of place, you know, even that sense of awe or the sense of gratitude or the sense of mystery or that kind of trying to connect these abstract metaphors that you that you're like emotionally feeling. I'm not articulating this very well, or it's quite similar, isn't it, to the divine.
It is, yes. I mean, I didn't think that I'd be talking about this, but it's interesting because I think I don't, you know, you mentioned this in some companies and they look at you, as if you're half crazy or fully crazy. But to me, it is, I think it's because it's the only thing, it kind of gives me a sense of another world in a way. Do you know what I mean? It's because you are creating things that you feel, even characters that don't exist other than in your head, but for you it's so real. As a writer, you know, when you put it down on paper, it's wonderful. And when people come to talk to you about your book, oh, they'll say, oh yeah, but thank God it's only a story. And and for you as a writer, it's not really, because you've kind of pulled it out of yourself. And you know, it is a kind of, it's such a very it's, you're not a doctor, you know, you're not somebody out there who's kind of you know, you're not a plumber, you're not a, you know, you're a writer who deals with images and words. And you sometimes do stop and say, what is it I am doing? What is it I am doing that's any kind of use or good in the world, you know? And then you look back, as I do, and you look at all the writers then who came out and said things, and you realize it's just a different way of being in the world. Even though you're in your head, you wouldn't be a writer if you weren't of the world, do you know? Like even Emily Bronte, say, she adored the parsonage, that's where she wanted to be. But she's still of the world because she was able to kind of, you know, create these characters that were just so, extremely violent. Yes. You know, but they were still real, you know. They were based on things or people or stories she heard about, you know. So it's just a very, to me, it's quite sacred, to tell you the truth. You know, and I'm not a very, like, I was born and raised Catholic and I'm not very Catholic anymore. But I honestly respect people with a sense of belief because I think that's what I have from my writing.
You know? And you do get that when you walk around in someone else's consciousness, if it's that type of novel. Obviously, there are some novels that aren't like that, and there's everything. But if we're talking about this kind of a book, that you are experiencing, there is that communion with them from whatever century they, which is also another kind of layer on it, where you're kind of also time traveling into someone else's sacred space or whatever. And bring it back to you and your experience of reading, just on what we're talking about there. Is there a book that is kind of, that you've been able to wander about in and that has given you comfort or escape, or kind of like, okay, I'm going into this book now. This is going to do the trick for me. It's what I need right now.
And it's not a great tome. It's not a great, it's not James Joyce or anything or anybody. It's actually Dodie Smith's, what's the word now? And I have it at my...
Capture the Castle, I know the book.
Capture the Castle, yeah, that one. I mean, I just love it. I love it because, I mean, it's really quite, it's just lovely. Her prose is beautiful and it's so simple. And it is like just going, when I read it, it's like going into, as I said, it is like living in a castle, which is something I would love to do. but it's a big roaring fire. It could be stormy outside or whatever, but I've got my dogs and or my dog, and everybody else in the castle is busy doing their own thing and they're all happy. And I'm just squirreled up in an armchair in front of the fire with my books. And that's what it's like. So if ever I do feel down, I go for that book, not for anything other, like no other great, you know, wonderful poetry or anything, even though I adore it. It's just for that kind of sucker, because that the girl in that book loved books as well and loved writing. And I just loved the whole story behind it. So, yes, that's my go-to book when I need to kind of sort of remind myself, yes, I'm a writer and I love words, and let's just sit here by the fire and read. And that's what I do.
I'd love to do that right now, Orla. Yeah. It just sounds exactly what the doctor ordered.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you a hard question for a writer, and that's of your own work, and I mean published and unpublished too. If there's something of your own work that you would save over all of it from the flames?
Over all of it, I think I'd like to save all of it, but if I had to save it just one, I would save my latest collection because of short stories, because I feel like I really, as a writer, I sort of, this is the one that I really gave myself permission to write, you know, like stories in there that you write and you think, oh God, or I don't think people will be able to go for this. But I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to go for it, because you have to have the courage of your words, you know. So so that's it. So I would, that would be the one I would choose, even just one copy of it. I would take that. And I'd hate to leave all the other burning books, but I would take that because I owe that to myself as a writer, you know, because it took me ages, Ruth. It took me ages, ages upon ages to give myself permission to write. I used to write stories, and even though they'd be good and they'd be published or whatever, I would always feel, and I still do to some state, feel ashamed of like how dark they can be. But it's just something that you have to grasp. You have to, you know, you just have to go for it, because, you know, you don't want to be sort of, you know, not to sound too traumatic on your deathbed and realize, oh my God, I didn't do that and I should have done that. Why was I so afraid? But I think it's just my nature to be reticent. And then it's also my nature to step over the reticence.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, you have to, I suppose.
It's that, the word exposing, really, isn't it? Or vulnerable when you're talking about, it's easy to say, isn't it? You need to that Zadie Smith line about tell the truth with whatever veil comes to hand.
Yeah.
But tell it, that's very easy to say, but God, if you're looking at that and you think, can I actually go there? It's not easy.
It's not easy, and it's not encouraged. And you know, maybe that's but it's not really, you know, it's just a very kind of it's not sort of accepted in some, you know, at some time, you know, especially, you know, yourself, if you're giving a reading and you're reading something and somebody comes up to you and says, well, I hated that, which has been happened to me, but it's what you think. Yeah, okay, you hated it, but it got to you.
Frankly, someone took the time to come up and tell you that they hated it.
Yeah. Yes, and so I think you just, writers who write like that, like you, like me, we're always going to be here. We mightn't always have a big bite of the cherry, or we mightn't be, but we're there. What was it that Jean Rees said, that she was just happy enough to be a trickle going into a big lake? But what a trickle, like a trickle that stood out. Do you know? So, yes. So that's, I think you just have to do it. You know, you just have to do your thing, and then somebody will notice someday, you know.
I'm going to, I was going to ask you one of the fun questions, but I know you're not going to leave anything in there to burn. And I actually just now we're talking about three houses in Rome. I kind of just want to stay with it because we're in there now. So you're going to tell the listeners a little bit about the collection, and then also we're going to end with maybe you reading from one of the stories.
I'll do that. The collection, as I said, I'd taken a long break from writing because I had written two novels and they got nowhere, and two extra novels. So I've got these two novels languishing, and I don't know if they'll ever do anything. The second one, I can remember when my ex-agent finally, a lovely, lovely agent, but we just weren't, we're compatible.
Compatible.
Yeah. And I kind of sensed that from the beginning, but I went ahead with it because I thought, well, what do you do when somebody says, yeah, I'd love to represent you, you know? And anyway, he loved the book I wrote, I couldn't reach him. And he, wouldn't answer my phones. And so I did this kiddish thing. So I went to my mother's phone, landline, and I rang. And so he spoke to me. He said, Orla, he said, listen, he said, every publisher in Britain and Ireland have turned you down. And I said, everyone? And he said, yes, everyone. He said, I sent it out to everyone. And I went home. And that was it. That was the end. I just kind of scuttled back into my shell and I just decided, oh my God, I don't know what I'm doing here. And I broke with the agent because it just seemed the way he told me things that he was just feeling he couldn't do much more for me. And so we broke amicably, actually really lovely. He sent me a really lovely email after I sent an email saying, you're fired. I didn't say that, but it was very nicely said. Let me put you that. And so anyway, he sent me back a lovely email. He said he understood. And then I just thought, that's it. So I think a couple of years went by and I didn't send anything out. I didn't want to look at writing. I didn't want to do anything about writing. I was really, really down about it. And then finally I spoke, which I will always have the best of regard for, the writer Alan McMonagall, who said to me, would you consider sending short stories to Dura Press? And so he said, look, I'll talk to them, I'll say. And so I got a lovely email from Lisa Smith, and from Dura Press. And she asked me, she said, we're interested. So I sent them something and it wasn't great. And they said, yes, we'd love to publish you. And I said, oh my God. And so back and forth. And then back and forth, and finally that's how I just had all these strange dark stories swirling in my head, and I just said, I'll get them down and I will send them to them, and they did, and they said yes, let's go for it. And so that's it. So that's how that came about, and that's why I'm proud of this collection, because it really, as I said to you before, Ruth, it was the first collection where I decided, to hell with everything, I'll just write what I want to write, and if it never gets read, I'm still a writer. If it never gets published, I'm still a writer, which is very difficult to accept. Do you know, it's like it basically kind of, it screws up your stomach to accept that, but it was necessary for me to accept it in order to be able to write these stories.
I think those are actually really wise words for anyone listening who's in that situation right now. And it can be quite freeing to just go, okay, so for all these other things that people are talking about, the market, the blah, the blah.
Yes.
This is what it comes back to, is the work, isn't it? It always comes back to that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so this is, would you say, I mean, now that you have the book in your hands, how do you feel seeing it as a living thing now?
It's lovely. It's beautiful. I love it. I love the look of it. I love the fact that the cover is full of houses because it has a very European look to me, you know. And sometimes I'm a bit in awe of myself that I actually did it. So sometimes I'll only look at it quickly and look away. But I do. I actually, for the first time in my writing life, feel utterly proud of what I've done, utterly proud. And, you know, there'd be stories in there now that people would pick at and say, well, this is not good. And my answer to that is it's damn good. It's my creation. It's damn good by my standards.
So what are you, I'm just looking at what opens this book. To be alive and to be a writer is enough.
Yes.
Catherine Mansfield.
Yes.
So what are you going to read, or from which story are you going to read from for us?
I was going to read a story. I didn't really want to read anything that's completely dark or anything, you know. So I thought if I read something that's just
dark, is fine.
Are you sure?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I read something now, if I just get it. It's you were talking earlier about going into the past and into the lives of people in the past. Mm. Sometimes I find that's good, you know. And I was there's an artist that I adore, Charlotte Solomon. I'm actually working on something about her, you know, a project about her, and which is about her and me and something else. I don't know exactly what was going to happen, but anyway, she was German Jewish and she was just starting out as an artist. Didn't think much of her artistry, but then her mother died, and she was determined to leave school at 16 because by this time the Hitler was in power and he was getting rid of the Jews, getting them rid of all institutions and everything. But she managed to be the only Jewish person in the art school in Berlin. And the only reason they allowed her in was, well, she was very good at art, they said. She was good at art, but she was so nondescript that none of the proud kind of erring Nazis, proto-Nazis in there, you know, the artists, would be interested in her. She also didn't look Jewish. She had blonde hair, blue eyes, and ruddy cheeks. But anyway, what happened to her was she was sent off to live with her grandparents in south of France to keep her safe. But her grandmother committed suicide, and this whole story about the suicides of women in the family came to light. She never knew this. And she also knew that she only had a permit to mind her grandfather. And then she had nothing else. So the Nazis were coming, like the Third Reich were coming down. They were already in the north of France, and they were saying to the southern governments, which was kind of, it was sort of Italian run and French, saying, keep an eye on the Jews, your Jews there, because we're going to come for them at some point, you know? So in the end, when she realized about all these suicides in her family, she thought either she would kill herself or she would have to do something wildly crazy, which was where she wrote this thing, my theater, Leben oder Theater, which is Leben oder Theater, which is life or theater, where she looked at her life and rewrote the life without her in it as such. And it's amazing. So I just try to imagine what would it take a person to know that there was no way out, and all these Jewish people that you knew were killing themselves all around you, and you had no permits, they had no permits. So how do you live if you don't want to kill yourself? How do you live and how do you create? So that's what I said. So I'll just read a bit of that, okay? sorry. Okay, hold on, I'll just try and see. If I just talk a bit about what she did create, maybe. Mm-hmm. So I'll just read a little bit of that, actually. It'll give people an idea of what she did. I would create my own life as if it were on a stage with pictures, fat, big pictures, sometimes pages with whole faces, sometimes pictures run into each other like a film reel. I can show footsteps walking on the page, the same figure walking after itself, motion and distance. I can divide up pages to show scenes. I use three colors, red, blue, and yellow, with a little white to mix. A three-color opera after Brecht, with song and music. There will be a narrator moving like a camera in third person. There is a prologue, a main part, and an epilogue. A playbill announces three-colored Singspiel. It takes place between 1930 and 1940 in Germany and in Nice. The cast for the prologue, Herr and Frau Nahr, their daughters Francesca and Charlotte, Dr. Kahn, medical doctor, Charlotte, his daughter, and Polinka Bimbam, a singer. The main part, Amadeus Daberlon, Polinka's lover and later Charlotte's, Frau Nahr, Herr Nahr, and Charlotte Kahn. The epilogue, Charlotte Kahn and her grandfather, Herr Nahr. Prologue. Scenes slip sideways, turn vice and versa, compress and elongate. The first Charlotte is Charlotte Nahr. She is 18 years old, and one night she walks out of her family home, walks through the night lit streets, walks beyond the town, and walks into a lake to drown herself. Her sister, Francesca, later becomes an angel who descends from heaven in through a bedroom window in Berlin to soothe her little daughter, Charlotte Kahn, whose papa has told her that her mother died from influenza. Charlotte's mother, lying in her bed, the nurse exits via the background. In the foreground is the windowsill. There is Francesca drawing the curtains. She stands inside the right-hand windowpane. There are spots of flowers, yellow and green grass stalks. She jumps to her death. Frau Nahr spends her days crying, "My little Francesca is dead. First my Charlotte, now my Francesca." Dr. Kahn sits in his green-grey chair and tears his nails into his face. There is something deep and terrible in the house, and it has made Francesca sick, so she killed herself. It is a large skeleton that follows little Charlotte down the hallway. Its shoulders spread over the tops of the walls. It is monstrous. The hall is red. Charlotte runs from its legs. And she runs to the bathroom and sits there in the rim of the bath. She stares at the toilet. So that is life. That.
You've been listening to the wonderful Orla Foyle reading from her new collection, Three Houses in Rome, which is out now with Dara Press. Join me next time when I'll be talking with novelist Noel O'Regan. See you all then.